Welcome to the Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, we are talking with Archie Hamilton, who runs Splatter, China's first integrated music promotion and brand activation agency. His team manages campaigns for brands seeking to leverage music effectively in their communication strategy. He also runs Splitworks, which promotes music independently, owns and runs three of China's biggest music festivals and books artists all through Southeast Asia. He also worked on the launch of the Motorola Razr back in the day and blogs at chinamusicradar.com. I am Kyle Berlin, a user experience researcher and music technology writer.
And I'm Courtney Harding. I develop and manage partnerships at SoundDrop, a social music application for Spotify, web, and iOS devices.
As I said at the top of the show, we are joined by Archie Hamilton. Say hello, Archie.
Hey guys.
Hi. Let's just sort of dive right in. And you have a ton to tell us about China, which we're excited about. So I guess we'll get started sort of at the beginning. What is the history of indie rock in China and both sort of Western rock and Chinese indie rock? And in terms of Chinese indie rock, are you seeing bands stick around sort of longer than they used to and really build careers playing music?
Hey, okay, well, I mean, that's quite a broad starting point. I could probably go on for a few hours on just those couple of questions. I think just to take it from the beginning, I mean, obviously in the late 70s we had the Cultural Revolution in China, and that was a fairly momentous, I mean, that's the understatement of the century, but that was a very momentous occasion, in terms of, on one side of it, there was no culture at all. And on the other side of it was the beginnings of I suppose, the new age of communism with capitalist tendencies. So the idea of liberalizing markets, reforming the country from top to bottom, which obviously included media and culture and entertainment. So it really was a standing start. 1979, there was nothing at all. There were eight revolutionary operas, and the thoughts of Mao set to music. That was all anybody could listen to in the country. And since then, we've seen a kind of punk and metal phase through the late 80s and early 90s. Tiananmen was obviously a huge, the problems that China had in 1989 with Tiananmen was fairly momentous. And a young singer called Sui Jian came to the fore with a song called Nothing to My Name, which became the kind of the official anthem of the student protesters. And then from that point, we've gone through the 90s. Nirvana's, well, Kurt Cobain's biography was translated into Chinese in 1997, which was also a fairly remarkable and important moment for young Chinese who were interested in Western culture and music in particular. And there was this phenomenon called the Daco or cut CD, which has been incredibly influential. That was the beginnings of Western culture in China, where a lot of the labels, independent and majors, would send their CDs, their overflow, overspill, to be recycled in China. And to make sure that they weren't unsold, they would put cut in the CD. But the Chinese recyclers unsold these. Rather than recycling, they unsold them through kind of grey market, black market distributors, DVD shops, and the like. And there's actually quite an interesting little documentary, 15-minute documentary that a young student put together last year, which I can send you the link to later, but which is like a history of the cut CD, and basically, acts like, well, labels like 4AD in the 80s would send their excess stock to China, and as a result, bands like the Pixies and the Cocteau Twins and Sonic Youth have actually developed quite a reasonable following here, as that was pretty much the first exposure that Chinese kids had to Western music. The second half of that question was Chinese bands, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I know that, like for a while, it seemed like Chinese bands would sort of appear for a few years and then disappear. And there weren't a ton of people that were building careers making music. And I from what I know, that has changed in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was very little stickability until the advent of a relatively free internet, which I think happened a little later than in the West. You know, in the West, we've had a relatively free internet, but a relatively robust internet since the late 90s, early 2000s. Here, it was a little later. It was around 2007 when the first social networks emerged. You know, before social networks, it was very much, you know, portal controlled. So you had the big four, you had NetEase, Sohu, Sina, and I think Tencent might have been the other one, but I'm not sure that Tencent was ever a media portal. And those were very easy for the censors to manage. You know, it was a kind of steady flow of information from one source, and they could apply a lot of pressure on those particular sources. Then in 2007, the advent of social media allowed, you know, kind of many-to-many communication. And so suddenly the censors were kind of on the back foot. They didn't know, I mean, they didn't possibly appreciate for quite a long time how potent this form of communication was. And so the genie was kind of let out of the bottle. And obviously that's been really influential in many spheres, but also culturally. You know, before, in the age of the portal, you know, it was very, this is, you know, similar to the West, I suppose. You know, when it was portal controlled, you know, you still had to buy your way in. You know, there was and then there was this kind of what I look at as a bit of a golden age. You know, the MySpace golden age, I suppose, where for a couple of years at least, and then maybe even a couple of years with Facebook, it was possible for artists who maybe weren't quite as, you know, didn't have the money or the support or the back end to buy their way into success, but were technologically savvy and could build their careers off the back of, you know, a good MySpace page or a good Facebook account or whatever. And, you know, obviously that was then co-opted by the big businesses, and now we're seeing a state where, you know, we're almost back to the way it was before, where you have to have money and support and infrastructure behind you to make an impression on these services. But that also happened in China. You know, there was a stage where, you know, on Douban, which was I think the first real kind of music and arts related social network, which became popular around 2007. There was really a moment in time where, you know, everything was disintermediated, and you could actually, you know, if you were savvy in on the service early and built your profile and stuff, you could actually build a kind of an early stage career for yourself that you could then leverage ongoing. Allied to that, you know, at the same time, festivals came into the mix. And also, I suppose brands came into the mix. You know, there was this movement away from state-run everything. So, you know, before that point, it was, you know, CCTV, which is the main broadcaster here, and then the main portals, and that was the only way to get to the people. Then came this point where you could actually get your own message across to the people without spending a lot of money, and that allowed us and others to set up, you know, touring networks and festivals, and also allowed us to to take some of the brand dollars that would have pretty much exclusively gone to mainstream media before, and pull them away into kind of these other areas, you know, experiential and, you know, digital and all these kind of things. So there was a moment in time there that suddenly the old rules were kind of broken apart and a new set of rules were created. And as a result, bands, you know, indie bands here and indie labels and whatever else have managed to create an ecosystem where increasingly bands can and artists can actually afford to devote themselves full time to their art, I suppose. And I think that's a global phenomenon, you know, through live and through brand endorsements and stuff, you can have a career. We never had recorded music in China. So we've never had the luxury of, you know, we didn't have what came before. You know, there was obviously a period from the 70s to the 2000s and even before that where artists could support themselves on recorded music, but we never had that. So this is the first time that bands have had that, and it's been eye-opening and illuminating. Sorry, that took quite a long time.
No, that's okay. Kyle, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I'd like to kind of change the topic over to how people are listening to and discovering music in China. You know, a lot of us follow the music consumption trends in North America, but I'd be curious to hear what kind of consumption trends you're seeing in China.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, this is the first time that there have been consumption trends, I suppose. You know, before there was no physical market necessarily. And the only way that people got access to music was really through state-owned radio and state-owned TV. So it was a very limited palette. And it was very kind of homogenous and kind of corporate owned, I suppose. This disintermediation has led to, you know, massive disruption. And while we haven't and probably will never see the rise of physical, you know, that again, this is the kind of leapfrog effect that China experiences in a lot of different areas and respects. The idea that, you know, again, like the PC, you know, the majority of Chinese have gone straight from nothing to the smartphone. So the PC generation, even the laptop generation, even the tablet generation hasn't got any sort of sense of scale, because they're considered relatively obsolete. And so the same with physical, you know, that people don't have CD players and certainly no tape decks. And, you know, although there is a very niche sort of vinyl explosion, when I say very niche, I mean, it's really, really niche. There's like two record shops in Shanghai and a couple of record shops in Beijing. But, you know, there is that obsessive, you know, kind of music junkie that wants to buy vinyl, and there is an emerging market for that. But the vast majority is streaming. And obviously, you know, Spotify isn't here, Pandora isn't here, RDO isn't here, Deezer isn't here. None of the main international services are here. And like almost anything, there are fantastic clones here in China. So the first big service was a company called Xiaomi, Xiaomi, which basically hosted the entire world's repertoire on their servers without licensing it at all. So there was no question of paying anyone for the music, and so it was a free service that was developed and actually managed to create a pretty massive audience. I mean, I'm not sure of the exact figures because everything like this is quite opaque in China, but certainly in the multi-millions, probably multi-tens of millions of users, and increasing all the time. Xiaomi was actually bought last year by Alibaba. I don't know if you're familiar with Alibaba. There's kind of a huge West NASDAQ listing that's either just about to happen or has just happened. And Alibaba is basically the mother company or the father company of Taobao and Tmall, which are massive platforms, transactional platforms for sale. So Taobao is basically a series of online shop fronts where anyone can come and set up a shop front and sell whatever they want for free. And Taobao, rather than taking commission on that, charges people for kind of placement. So if you're a shop selling, you know, bath toys, you advertise yourself to come up in the search in the searches for bath toys. Now Taobao and Tmall, Alibaba did revenues of $272 billion last year. That's transactional revenue, so not actually, you know, revenue of their own, but they processed sales of $272 billion last year. Which when compared to something like Amazon did $74 billion and eBay did $16 billion. So Alibaba does about three times as much in transactional value as you know, eBay and Amazon globally put together. So it's a huge, huge company. And it sucked in Xiaomi last year, probably, well, most likely because it's trying to add volume to the IPO. So Xiaomi is now, you know, still very much the preeminent service. And there are some other ones. So Baidu have a music service. Baidu is the biggest search engine. So in China, I mean, just for context, basically the internet's closed largely. So, and there are two reasons for that. One is that the Chinese government demands that all companies that are active on the Chinese web host their servers in China, so they can basically go in at any point physically and just confiscate servers or certainly look through them for, you know, and trace where badness is coming from in their mind, which is why Facebook's blocked and Google's blocked and YouTube's blocked and Twitter's blocked. So there's the censorship part, but also, you know, they've blocked all of this stuff to give their domestic champions a head start. So they've created essentially clones of all of those services. So Facebook is Renren, Twitter is Weibo, WhatsApp is Weixin, eBay is Tmall, or, you know, I mean, there are lots of services. Dating apps have clones. So effectively, you know, and in our niche, you know, Pandora is Xiaomi or Dormi or whatever music service there is. And, you know, last week I managed to find Aphex Twin's new album, Syro, on Dormi, which is a week before it came out anywhere in the world. So these guys have got their shit together in an amazing way. You know, if you don't have to license the music, you can actually collect a pretty formidable catalog. And these guys have got some of the deepest and widest catalogs anywhere. But of course, no one's getting paid for it yet. So it's kind of a conundrum.
Wow, even I haven't been able to find that Aphex Twin record. I guess I should try to look on the Chinese servers.
Well, the thing is that they're all geo-blocked. You can get a VPN.
Yeah.
So the same way that we have VPNs to tunnel out of China, you know, to get past the so we can use Facebook and Twitter and all these other services. What I discovered when I was in Scotland last week is that I can actually, you know, it's kind of ironic. I'm now using my VPN to tunnel back into China, so I can listen to these services and stuff. It's kind of gone full circle.
Wow. So I kind of want to switch topics a tiny bit and talk about a post that you wrote recently that you and I have talked about before. And you wrote about a big sort of corporate, I think it was Budweiser sponsored an EDM festival in China, and it didn't go that well, which to me is interesting because I feel like there's almost this plug and play EDM festival model that works pretty much anywhere in the world. Like, you could put the same 50 DJs inside a stadium in, you know, South Korea or Johannesburg or, you know, Buenos Aires or New York, and you'd get a pretty big crowd. But in China, you don't think that's the case. And so I'm curious for you to talk a little bit more about, you know, why that sort of plug and play big EDM festival model doesn't work in China.
Well, I mean, let's just backtrack a little bit. So the article I wrote on China Music Radar was kind of an opinion piece about EDM generally and the rise of this kind of corporate EDM model in China, similar to the rest of the world. Now, Storm, which is the big festival in question, had its first edition last year, backed by, I'd imagine, private equity or venture capital. And it was, you know, for China, a pretty big production. It had some pretty big artists. It had a lot of logistical issues. And one of the main problems was that not very many people turned up, which, you know, is down to a lot of things that I won't go into today. Off the back of that, they negotiated a big deal at the beginning of the year or the end of last year with Budweiser, who came in for, you know, a significant multi-million dollar amount of money. But the organizers were contractually obliged to do, I think, 80 kind of club shows, warm-up club shows, eight or nine warehouse shows, and the big festival in October. So the festival hasn't actually happened yet. What we've seen all summer is a bunch of kind of Budweiser Storm, it's now called the Budweiser Storm Festival, a bunch of Budweiser Storm pop-ups around the country in clubs and bars and sort of, in inverted commas, warehouses. And the festival is going to happen the 4th and 5th of October, and will feature, they released the lineup a couple of weeks ago, maybe a few weeks ago. You know, it's, you can pretty much close your eyes and guess who the top eight acts are. You know, it's Avicii and you know, I can't even remember, probably Deadmau5 and Axwell and Ingrosso and whoever else. You know, it's pretty standard. Now, obviously, last year it didn't work very well. You know, I think they got maybe four or five thousand people a day, when they probably would have needed 30,000 or 40,000 people to break even. But they have big long pockets. You know, there's a huge appetite for this kind of investment around the world at the moment, as you guys have seen in America and in Europe with SFX and, you know, Live Nation and all these other guys acquiring left, right, and center. So the situation is somewhat different in China, you know, and I go into quite lengthy detail in the post as to the reasons why. You know, EDM as it stands today has basically been built on the back of 25, 30 years of rave culture. So this is the ravers growing up and needing to make money or wanting to make money or you know, changing the game a little bit. So you look at the guys that run most of the big operations, you know, IDT in Holland and Insomnia and, you know, Hard and Ultra and all these other guys. You know, the founders and generally the CEOs are all guys who started doing free parties or warehouse parties or rave parties back in the 90s. They're all, you know, my age, late 30s, early 40s. And they've been in the game for 20 years. You know, they understand where it's come from. They understand and have deep relationships with all the players, you know, the DJs and whatever else. You know, I was reading a review of the Dekmantel Festival in Holland a couple of days ago and an interview with the founders. The Dekmantel Festival is kind of like, has been pretty much proclaimed as the best new electronic music festival in Europe. It's based in Holland and, you know, it's very much on the sort of techno, the harder end, the Detroit, the slightly more purist end of it. You know, and you read the interview with the founders and they talk all about the fact they've been doing this for 20 years and they have all these relationships and you know, they can pull together a great lineup for a festival in its first or second year because of their history. Now, in China, the people doing it here mostly are coming at it fresh. You know, the guys certainly behind Storm hadn't heard of EDM 18 months ago. or electronic music or anything to do with dance music. So they're basically seeing a trend, and as happens in a lot in China, they're raising a shitload of money, and they're going at it, you know, the only way they know how, which is by throwing a shitload of money at it. And so, you know, my deep kind of belief is that, yeah, sure, if they have, you know, multiple millions of dollars to waste for the next 5 years, they'll probably get to a position where they can be dominant. But in my experience, and, you know, I've taken on investment before, particularly for festivals, you know, and I've taken on brands for festivals. The corporates don't have that kind of time horizon. You know, if you're gonna just throw something in there and try and make it the biggest thing ever and break it down like that, you need a five year plus time horizon. And so since Storm kind of announced, there's another one which is going to happen in Shanghai 2 weeks later called the Top 100. I mean, Jesus, the name, you know, the Top 100 DJ Festival. It's like, you know, you can't even begin to imagine. So within 2 weeks of each other, you've got these two festivals which have basically all of the big EDM artists sort of half between them. So the other one is like Steve Aoki and Giorgio Moroder, and, you know, I mean, they have another headliner, Fatboy Slim. So the Top 100 DJ Festival is actually put on by, you know, is a collaboration between this big group of nightclubs in Shanghai, I think, called the Sino Group. They've bought into, oh God, and I should probably give some history on the nightclubs and the nightclub situation in China as well to give this some context. Sorry, guys, I hope this isn't too crazy long. Just cut me off if you need to.
No, this is really interesting because I think 99.9% of the people that listen to this podcast have, like, know zero about the music scene in China. So this is really interesting. Yeah.
Well, seriously, just cut me off and shut me down if you need to. So just really briefly, I mean, there's been a club scene in China for 10 years, maybe a little bit longer. We actually did a Chivas sponsored tour with Tiesto in 2005, taking him to five cities in China. And before I actually arrived in China, because I arrived in 2005, Tiesto did another Heineken sponsored tour in 2003, right? So there is a history of this stuff happening. So it's like when I say that Storm is like, you know, or EDM or this year is like the beginning of it, that's not entirely true. The thing is that, you know, these DJs and the music was very much just window dressing for the last 10 years. The club industry in the main cities has been all about face, which is a very deep characteristic in China, you know, how to show face in public. Basically, you know, the Chinese economy is running at the moment on, you know, certainly for the last 10 years, on who can make the most money and who can flaunt that. And so the clubs are a very good way to do it. And if you've read the recent Vice articles, I mean, I can send you links. But, you know, Vice wrote a fairly sensationalist article about, you know, the clubbing culture in China, which is sensationalist, but there is some truth rooted in it, whereby, you know, the Chinese consume by sitting at tables in these clubs. So the dance floors in these clubs are tiny. You know, some of them don't even have a dance floor. You know, even though they're paying these DJs a shitload of money to come out and play, it's a face thing again. And the club is made up of tables, and the Chinese consumers will go to these clubs and will sit at these tables and will order bottle service. Now, you know, previously it was all about whiskey, and, you know, it was relatively low-key because, don't forget, you know, 10 years ago, China was a very flat society. You know, it was post-communist, still the trappings of kind of consumerist and capitalist luxury were fairly thin on the ground. And it wasn't recommended that you showed off how much money you had, because, you know, generally people would know that if you had lots of money, you probably made it fairly illegally. But in the last 10 years, something changed. It became okay to flaunt your wealth. And so the last 10 years, we've seen this kind of this steady flow of and this is a generational shift, right? Because the first generation to make money in China were born and brought up in inside the Cultural Revolution and the Mao days, so had a real understanding of you know how dangerous life could be, and we're sitting in a situation now where the children of those people who have been handed a ton of money because their parents, you know, it's the one child policy, right? So. So the parents are giving their kids everything they want in terms of financial and luxury or whatever else. These kids have no connection to that era, the pre-culture or the Cultural Revolution or whatever. So they're suddenly spending all this crazy amount of money with no real embarrassment or no real kind of hold on it. And so you're getting these situations where in these clubs, you know, now, you know, first of all, people are driving up to the clubs and parking their cars outside, right? And we're talking, you know, $2 million, $3 million supercars. So that's the first thing. You know, you walk up to one of these clubs and there'll be a Ferrari and a Lamborghini and a Bentley and a Rolls Royce all sitting outside. And, you know, the people will then go in and then they'll sit at their table that they booked. And they'll order, you know, tens or even sometimes hundreds of bottles of, like, you know, Jeroboam's of vintage champagne. And it's become this kind of competition, right, where table X orders 10 bottles and table Y orders 20 bottles and table Z orders 30 bottles. And, you know, the servers will come out with, you know, a kind of firework display when you spend over a certain amount with these kind of plastic see-through baths, ice baths, full of the champagne or whatever, and they'll put it on your, you know, kind of underlit on your table so people can see how much you're spending. And it's become this big swinging dick competition, you know, just crazy, crazy kind of one-upmanship. And so that's what club culture has been all about, right? No one gives a fuck about the music. It's just dice games and bottle service and hot women and stuff. And so, you know, where you've got big festivals in the West that have been built off the back of club culture, and so people understand what it is to dance, people know how to dance, people are comfortable with the idea of going with their friends somewhere and getting wasted and dancing for the whole night. You know, these festivals in China, they all finish because curfew for outdoor events is 10 p.m. So they're all finished by 10. You've only got like 3 or 4 hours of darkness. And, you know, most Chinese consumers, they don't really like to go outside much. You know, it's a very indoor culture here. People like air conditioning. There are very few green spaces. No one goes to the country for the weekend. You know, there's no hiking. There's no camping. Nothing like that. So the idea of going and hanging out in a park to recreate an experience that you could have in the club, in my opinion, is not something that's going to change overnight. And so these big electronic music festivals, you know, they're launching at the same size as their counterparts in the US or in South Africa or Europe or whatever, but they have none of the culture that kind of goes with it. Does that make sense? I mean, that's a really long answer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. And I wanted to bring up one other thing that you mentioned in the piece, which is that there's really not a drug culture in China. There's not an ecstasy culture or a Molly culture or whatever they're taking these days. EDM shows, I mean, and I think that's another part of it, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's face it. The you know, EDM has been predicated on 20 years of drug culture, and people go to these shows and they go there to get fucked up. You know, although what I'm seeing in the West is that seems to be changing as well. You know, this is kind of what I write in the article, is that these worlds are beginning to collide. So, you know, the review that I read of Hakkasan in Las Vegas could be a review of a clubbing experience at M18 in Shanghai. you know, it's all about private and VIP tables. It's all about bottle service. It's all about who can sit the highest. And the DJs are being paid $1 million, right? To play. So actually, the two worlds are colliding at a kind of juncture with completely different backgrounds. And so there is a chance that this will work a lot more quickly in China than it would have anywhere else. But I still don't believe that's this year or next year, particularly when, you know, apart from these two big EDM festivals, there are probably about 6 or 7 other electronic music festivals that are launching this year. And there just isn't the audience for it. You know, you see this phenomenon in China, you know, the money chases the trends or the perceived trends, but there's so much money, investment money and gray money and whatever else kicking around, that whenever there's a perceived trend, you know, that 15 times too much money floods into that area and kills it immediately. And so, you know, if Storm had had 3 or 4 years to exist on its own, to build an audience, maybe they wouldn't have had to waste as much money, and maybe they would have had a better chance of building something sustainable. But because there are like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 other festivals that are launching around the same time, you know, there is probably not enough of an audience to at the moment to sort of satisfy half a Storm, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And now it's being split across 4 or 5 or 6 festivals. You know, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about another festival too. Like, not an EDM festival, but I noticed that Modern Sky, which is a Chinese sort of indie festival, is actually going to be happening in New York in October.
Sure.
Which, unfortunately, I'm going to be out of town that weekend, but it looks like a really incredible lineup. And I'm just wondering if that's sort of the start of something where maybe, you know, Chinese culture is starting to be exported to the West versus, you know, what's been happening in, you know, for the last several years is Western culture just gets exported everywhere else, but the West has sort of a wall around it. And mm-hmm. if this Modern Sky Festival is the start of something where it's, you know, the reverse of that, or something that's, you know, culturally Chinese is going to be exported to the U.S. and break outside of the sort of niche Chinese community.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a good point, and certainly that's what Modern Sky are hoping. You know, I think purely cynically that there's certainly, you know, export to the U.S. is like the big crowning glory. So I think Modern Sky have a few kind of founder sponsors, I suppose, you know, big Chinese companies that want a foothold in the US. And so Modern Sky are going there with money from these big organizations. And it, again, it's a face thing, right? It's like, you know, if you can tell your mates back in China that you have a festival in Central Park in New York, or if you're a brand and you can tell your mates, you know, at other brands that your brand is being represented at a cool music festival in Central Park, then that's certainly a lot of face. You know, the Chinese bands that have been touring the US and Europe for the last 5 or 6 years, I think it's probably been, no, probably 4 or 5 years. You know, everyone started with South by Southwest. You know, we helped a punk band get on the Vans Warped Tour in 2009. You know, Brian Jones, one of the guys, Ricky from Brian Jones Sand Massacre, has just organized, you know, has just taken a Chinese band on tour with them in Europe. You know, back in the day, Sonic Youth, who we brought here in 2007, you know, we put a band on the bill with them in Beijing, and they liked the band so much that they took them on tour with them the following year in Germany. So there have been these kind of isolated occurrences, and Modern Sky have certainly been as active as any in sending their key bands abroad. You know, they've been touring bands or taking them South by Southwest and touring them for the last certainly 3 or 4 years. You know, having been to an average Modern Sky festival in China, and, you know, I mean this with no disrespect, but it's certainly not a Western level of festival. you know, production is certainly not on a par. Logistics are certainly not on a par. You know, there are a lot of problems with the modern Sky and Strawberry festivals in China from a kind of production standpoint and an artist standpoint. You know, the artists certainly aren't big enough or experienced enough to be playing the main stages of big international festivals yet. And that, I suppose, is slightly my concern with it, is that, you know, exporting something that I don't think is necessarily export ready to probably the most discerning, or certainly one of the most discerning audiences in the world, is a big move. And certainly good, because most of the Chinese bands that are going are signed to Modern Sky's record label or management arm. And so giving them exposure, obviously, in the US will be good for them in the long term anyway. So from a strategic point of view, it makes perfect sense. You know, my concern is that I'm not sure that Modern Sky are in a position at the moment yet to represent themselves in a way that any interested parties in the US going would be, you know, unless they found a partner, you know, a really good festival partner in New York. You know, if they're going to do it themselves, then it's going to be a struggle. You know, I'm just worried that it won't represent itself particularly well, if that makes sense, or won't represent Chinese culture particularly well, because people are used to much, much better in the West.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at the lineup right now, and the lineup is, it's solid. It's, you know, some pretty good Western bands. They've got Cat Power, and they've got Liars, and certainly a couple of Chinese bands. So it's a decent lineup. The tickets are
quite reasonable as well. You think it's quite expensive?
$85 for 2 days for not massive bands? Well, it's New York. I mean, yeah.
That was my concern a little bit as well, you know, is that there isn't anything, you know, and this is the problem with Chinese festivals, right, is that they never pay up for, you know, for any band that really should be headlining a festival, if that makes sense. You know, so you know, if Liars is going to be your headliner, you know, your audience is going to be, you know, and maybe it'll be Cat Power or Lenka or something like that. But it's a very, I mean, these are all artists that Modern Sky have worked with in China. So all of those acts, the American acts or European acts, have been on, or Australian in the case of Lenka, have been on Modern Sky bills before. So it really is a true representation of the Modern Sky festival in China. You know, it's just that problem. You know, when I read about the Governor's Ball, for example, you know, and I look at the lineup there, and I don't know how much the ticket price is there, but I'd imagine it's probably $100 a day, right, or something like that.
Yeah.
So you're looking at something half the price, but I think you're probably going to get something that's, you know, it's debatable whether it'll be half the quality. And you know, my hope genuinely is that it succeeds, because I think it'll be a big step forward for the industry here. And I think it'll be a great beachhead for the artists from China to be representing on a stage in Central Park. And I think it'll be great learnings for Modern Sky. But, you know, my concern is that, you know, it will feel like a Chinese festival in New York, and possibly appeal more to a diaspora audience, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But you know, I don't know. My hope is that it'll do well. My instinct is that it's a few years before we're going to see successful Chinese festivals or bands being exported at that kind of level to the US.
Yeah.
That being said, Archie, I'd like to hear your perspective on what opportunities exist for Western artists and brands in China.
Good question. I mean, obviously we've been selling the Chinese dream to artists since 2005. And, you know, one of the things obviously is the size of the market. You know, I mean, it's a well of a lot of people, a lot of brands, and a lot of bands have been sucked in by that particular proposal or proposition. The question I actually asked my team yesterday, you know, we had a team meeting and we talked about our festivals for next year, and we talked about you know, our positioning for next year, and we talked about, you know, a lot of different things. And one of the things that I put to them, I suppose, because this is, you know, my team is, you know, 40 people, but, you know, 70-80% Chinese, is how do we start paying back on our promises to the artists, you know, because I'm getting hit up by agents and managers now of artists that we brought through, you know, years and years ago, saying what's going on, what's the next step, how do we make this work. And, you know, a lot of artists have come in at a no earning basis, some of them even at losses, with this idea that, hey, look, we're gonna you know, we're gonna make it in the long term. And, you know, what we've found, particularly in the live market over the last 5, 6, 7 years, is that there's a real kind of first time experience thing going on here. You know, where we'll bring a band in and people, it's a sort of bucket list principle, right? Where we bring in St. Vincent in 2010, or let's do an artist that we've done a few shows for. So Handsome First, for example, Canadian band, you know, Dan Beckner from Wolf Parade. We brought them in 2010, big Asian tour. You know, the show in China was kind of legendary that year as being the best show that China has ever seen, kind of thing. You know, it was a real one of those perfect storms where everything just worked out brilliantly. So we brought them back the next year on an extended tour of Asia. And although we got bigger shows around the rest of China, around the rest of Asia, we did slightly fewer tickets in Shanghai and Beijing, because although the shows were great and had been hyped beyond belief, you know, and it was a different time of year for sure, which, you know, a worse time of year to tour them. But I think there was that idea of bucket listing stuff. You know, I've seen that artist, and there are so many new artists coming in all the time that people are like, well, I'm going to move on to the next one, kind of thing. So my challenge to my guys was like, you know, how do we change that mentality? You know, how do we get people interested again in acts coming back? You know, and the response from most people was like, you know, we have to invest more time and more money and more effort in creating stickability for these acts. You know, talking to their fans through their social media sites on an ongoing basis across the intervening time between tours, kind of thing. And it's fairly basic, you know, from a label or an A&R or a management position, you know, always talking to people. But in China, we're still at that first stage, and obviously there's no investment or no money available for most of these artists because they're not selling any music and the touring opportunities are fairly limited and stuff, and it's not their home market. So for international artists, you know, the next stage when you talk about opportunities is, well, yeah, you can come, and yeah, there are lots and lots of festivals now, and if you can establish yourself as a good live band, then there's a possibility that these Chinese festivals might start bringing you back. And, you know, there are multiple festivals around the country. I mean, we're talking like 150 to 200 music festivals in China now. So, you know, there's a lot of activity on that front. But what you have to do is you either have to find partners that are willing to invest in you. And in the absence of any labels or management organizations here, that's a struggle. And you have to either do it yourself or pay someone else to do your PR, your kind of ongoing PR here. So you look at the football teams, for example, all right? So football is a big growing market in China. There are lots and lots and lots of fans of big kind of English Premier League teams or Spanish La Liga teams or whatever. And so these companies have started paying agencies in China to have active social media accounts for them so they can stay in touch, you know, with what's going on here. And they're repurposing. I mean, a lot of them, unfortunately, are just repeating the same content that they spew on Twitter and Facebook. And there isn't that kind of localization element. But some of the smarter ones are retaining local agencies to do that and maintain a footprint, I suppose. So from an artist's point of view, I do still think there's a huge opportunity, but I think it needs a lot of commitment, and I think possibly more commitment than a lot of Western artists are prepared or able to give, right? From a corporate perspective, it's been a pretty bad year for corporations here, honestly speaking, particularly multinationals. If you read the mainstream, not even the mainstream, but the business Chinese press or the business press about China, there's a lot of talk about, China's going through an anti-corruption phase. There's a very deep kind of a deep-rooted kind of purge on corruption. No one's quite sure whether that it's, I mean, it's mostly because the Communist Party's legitimacy is under debate, because the Communist Party is incredibly, it's incredibly kind of corrupt, I suppose. Lots of entrenched corruption here. And they realize that they're losing their legitimacy. So they're trying to root out corruption at the very deepest level, and they're actually taking on some pretty big players. The trouble is that a lot of the companies that are being highlighted, well, again, it's under debate, whether international foreign companies are being unfairly targeted. My own personal view is that there's been a lot of corruption even in Western companies. Well, particularly in Western companies, because the bosses are in New York or LA or London, and they're trying to manage the businesses here, and so the businesses locally get a little bit out of control, and there is a lot of corruption, a lot of bribery, a lot of craziness. So it's been a really tough year for business in China, allied to a slowing economy and kind of a lowering of consumption habits. But I see that as a kind of temporary, a temporary cycle. The business cycle here seems to go in like 3-year spurts. So we've had this good run since 2010, particularly in our industry, where more and more companies have piled on, and more investments gone in, and people are really fighting for space and air and stuff. And consumption's gone up a lot in the last 3 years. And now I think we're going through a little bit of a kind of rebalancing, where there's probably too much money in the system, and it needs to rebalance a little bit. Which means that we have a new cycle coming soon, hopefully. And that, I think, is where the opportunity is. Opportunities for international companies are the same as anywhere else. You can't just come to China, and this is what I talk a lot about at conferences and stuff. You can't just come to China and, expect to just do well by showing up. You need to adopt the same principles here as you'd adopt anywhere, which is, and you need to work back from a position that, hey, look, the Chinese consumer, particularly for multinationals, is probably unlikely to know my products. So we just did a campaign last year for Guinness, a music-based campaign for Guinness. And it was very, very hard to impress upon particularly the global team at Guinness that, hey, look, your brand needs to adopt the mentality of a startup here. Because, the Guinness team are like, well, we're the biggest beer brand, or one of the biggest beer brands in the world. Everyone knows who we are. We're this incredibly famous stout brand. We have 250 years of heritage, blah, 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 blah. And so they kind of come to China with that mentality. Hey, we're a massive brand, and China must know us as well, because everyone else does. And in China, there's absolutely no recognition, brand recognition of Guinness at all. You could put a bottle of Guinness or a pint of Guinness in front of someone, in front of your average, person on the street here, and I reckon one in 100,000 or even less would know, would be able to name it. That iconic black beer with the white head. Literally 0.0001% of people would know what that was. And so it's very hard for these companies to react to that, because they have this mentality that, hey, we're huge, so everyone knows us, so all we have to do is continue doing what we're doing elsewhere. And it's actually not, no, you have to go back into startup mode. And you have to really think, how do I start my brand going here? How did the people start my brand 250 years ago? And so that's the challenge that a lot of multinationals have. And that's why I think a lot of smaller businesses are being more successful here, because they have that kind of startup mentality when they come to China, and they push that through as part of their raison d'etre. That's a bit confused as well, sorry.
That's all right. Well, Archie, I mean, we're kind of reaching near the end of the hour here. It's been really fascinating hearing you talk about the Chinese market, how different artists and brands have succeeded there, and the overall sort of music market in general. If people want to find you and your company and your blog online, where can they find you at?
Well, the blog's just www.chinamusicradar.com, all one word. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. I'm on Facebook and Twitter at just Archie Hamilton. My companies are variously, actually you can get an overview of all of the companies, the Asian booking agency, the brand consultancy, the promoter, the festivals, all at splitunited.com. So just all one word, splitunited.com. And we've got all the social links there. So that's probably the best port of call.
That's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. And if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you.